Book 1, Washington Square. 1. He had come into the habit, before dinner, of taking a walk around the park. 10 laps, as slow as he pleased on some evenings, briskly on others, and then back up the stairs of the house and to his room to wash his hands and straighten his tie before descending again to the table. Today, though, as he was leaving, the little maid handing him his gloves said, "Mr. Bingham says to remind you that your brother and sister are coming tonight for supper." And he said, "Yes, thank you, Jane, for reminding me," as if he'd in fact forgotten. And she made a little curtsy and closed the door behind him. He would have to go more quickly than he would were his time his own. But he found himself being deliberately contrary, walking instead at his slower pace, listening to the clicks of his boot heels on the paved stones ringing purposefully in the cold air. The day was over, almost, and the sky was the particular rich ink purple that he couldn't see without remembering, achily, being away at school, and watching everything shade itself black, and the outline of the trees dissolve in front of him. Winter would be upon them soon, and he had worn only his light coat. But nevertheless, he kept going, crossing his arms snug against his chest and turning up his lapels. Even after the bells rang 5, he put his head down and continued moving forward, and it wasn't until he had finished his 5th circumnavigation that he turned, sighing, to walk north on one of the paths to the house, and up its neat stone steps, with the door opening for him before he reached the top, the butler reaching already for his hat.
"In the parlor, Mr. David."
"Thank you, Adams." Outside the parlor doors he stood, passing his hands repeatedly over his hair, a nervous habit of his, much as the repeated smoothing of his forelock as he read or drew, or the light drawing of his forefinger beneath his nose as he thought or waited for his turn at the chessboard, or any number of other displays to which he was given. Before sighing again, and opening both doors at once in a gesture of confidence and conviction that he, of course, did not possess. They looked over at him as a group, but passively, neither pleased nor dismayed to see him. He was a chair, a clock, a scarf draped over the back of the settee, something the eye had registered so many times that it now glided over it, its presence so familiar that it had already been drawn and pasted into the scene before the curtain rose.
"Late again,"
said John, before he'd had a chance to say anything. But his voice was mild, and he seemed not to be in a scolding mood, though one never quite knew with John. "John," he said, ignoring his brother's comment, but shaking his hand and the hand of his husband, Peter. "Eden," kissing first his sister and then her wife, Eliza, on their right cheeks. "Where's grandfather?"
"Cellar."
"Ah." They all stood there for a moment in silence, and for a second, David felt the old embarrassment he often sensed for the three of them, the Bingham siblings, that they should have nothing to say to one another, or rather, that they should not know how to say anything, were it not for the presence of their grandfather, as if the only thing that made them real to one another were not the fact of their blood or history, but him.
"Busy day?"
asked John, and he looked over at him quickly. But John's head was bent over his pipe, and David couldn't tell how he had intended the question. When he was in doubt, he could usually interpret John's true meaning by looking at Peter's face. Peter spoke less but was more expressive, and David often thought that the two of them operated as a single communicative unit, Peter illuminating with his eyes and jaw what John said, or John articulating those frowns and grimaces and brief smiles that winked across Peter's face. But this time Peter was blank as John's voice, and therefore of no help. And so he was forced to answer as if the question had been meant plainly, which it perhaps had. "Not so much," he said, and the truth of that answer, its obviousness, its undeniability, was so inarguable and stark that it again felt as if the room had gone still, and that even John was ashamed to have asked such a question. And then David began to try to do what he sometimes did, which was worse, which was to explain himself, to try to give word and form to what his days were.
"I was reading, but oh," he was spared from further humiliation.